Hello, everybody, and this is episode 357 of Film Wax Radio. My name is Adam Shartoff, and I'll be your host today for this episode. What do we have on this episode? We have two segments, plus a special appearance by our man in the field, Jacob Shartoff, who's going to talk about the movies he's seen so far over the what they call the summer. The summer blockbuster period, even though we're technically now just entering the summer, we'll have him on too in just a little bit. And then we're going to go to a conversation with Penny Lane, who was on this podcast a couple of years ago when she talked about her first feature, Our Nixon. And now she's back with a new documentary called Nuts. It's opening at Film Forum in New York, anyway, this Wednesday, June the 22nd, and in other cities as well. And then we're going to have on Brent Barber, who is the founding director of the Bicycle Film Festival, which is going to take place later this week on the 22nd as well, I think, through the 26th of June, to take place at the Anthology Film Archives in New York City. But, you know, this is a festival that takes place all around the world. They have all these different variations of the Bicycle Film Festival, but the one in New York, this is the flagship, is going to have its 16th annual festival later this week. Do go to the bicyclefilmfestival.com, and we'll have on Brent Barber on in just a little bit. But first, we're going to bring back, as I mentioned, Penny Lane. Our Nixon really was one of my favorite documentaries a couple of years back when it had its premiere. And I was very excited to find out that she was back with a new documentary. Now, this is another case. If you listen to my show with Morgan Neville on the last episode, he too had some older works that had been, you know, taking a long time to get done and then had a success and then was able to finish the older works. And likewise, Penny had started Nuts, I think, before Our Nixon, and she does talk about it on this segment. And she was able to finish it based on the success of Our Nixon. In this film, which is, I reference as being called inventive and wildly fun, Nuts recounts the unbelievable true story of John Romulus Brinkley, a Kansas doctor, who in 1917 discovered that he could cure impotence by transplanting goat testicles into men. And from there, the story only gets more bizarre. So anyway, we're going to talk to Penny about this rather unconventional documentary, which is full of beautiful animation, I should add, more than you would normally see in a documentary except with the exception of actual animated films. So let's, the film will be opening at Film Forum, as I mentioned, on June 22nd, which is coming right up. So without any further hesitation, let's get into my conversation with Penny Lane.
To cure your impotence, you want me to implant goat testicles into you.
Well, Doc, they can't be worse than the nuts I got.
Well,
sweet sugar, honey bunny. You can buy my love, young bunny.
First, they came bringing their own goats. Pretty soon, he had his own herd of goats out back. Patient would select a goat with which he felt the most connection. Then they would come in and do this sort of double operation.
My wife just gave birth to our first child. I am living proof
that the goat glands in my scrotus are working.
I'd show all of you right now if the ladies weren't present.
Are they shutting you down?
Is your form of medicine found in any textbook?
I highly doubt it.
Did you learn it in school?
Of course not.
Then how do you know it works?
Actually glad I looked over the press notes.
Okay.
I tried to remember to do it. I don't always have to because you know, I'm familiar with your work and I saw the new film and, you know, I can come to my own conclusion, but it is actually quite helpful to read those.
Who knew?
Well, I'm like, no, but it, you know, I'm such a pro. Anyway. No, but there's never enough information. It's all helpful. Like, one of the things I want to get to is this Penny, since we've already started.
Hello.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
You were on last time when our Nixon was having, I think, a screening at New Directors.
I think that's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we went sometime in that season.
Yeah. That was 2013. Oh, okay, so it wasn't like... Sometimes I think it's like 2013, but it's like 2009. I'm like, oh my God, is that true?
Yeah, only 3 years. Not so bad.
No, not at all. Not at all. In fact, from what the production notes said, you
were... Those helpful press notes.
You were working on this for 4 years.
Oh, more than 4 years.
More than four.
Almost eight.
Oh, was that right? So did you... You didn't start this before Our Nixon.
I did.
You did?
Yeah.
Did the enormous success of Our Nixon help to expedite the finishing of Nuts?
Probably. I mean, you know, I don't know. Probably, because Nuts is so weird and hard to explain. It wasn't super easy to fundraise for it, and particularly when I didn't have any other features.
Right.
So I do think that Our Nixon probably did help.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. I mean, what makes things change out there in the world, but maybe. Not that Nuts was really easy to fund even after Our Nixon. It wasn't, actually. We never actually raised our full budget. We just got it done, and then we sold it, so.
Yeah. Well, you mean Nuts?
Yeah.
Yeah, because, there is a significant amount of the film is animation, and it must have been painstaking and time-consuming for the animator since it was hand-drawn, is that?
Yeah.
Is that, again, going to the notes. now, that makes two films. Again, you made Our Nixon. Co-produced and directed Our Nixon, which, of course, was about sort of this found footage documentary about Nixon at play. Nixon at it was like Nixon not working.
Mm-hmm.
It was like in leisure time and just sort of having informal time with co-workers and family and things of that nature. And now we have a second one about this doctor. Right, I guess we can call him. Let's get to the point. He's a charlatan.
Yeah.
Right? And we'll talk about that. But now there's this two liars that you've made films about.
Mm-hmm.
Two big fat liars.
Yeah, two big fat 20th century liars.
Yeah.
They're pretty similar characters. Not really similar characters, but the sort of shape of their life stories is very similar. They're both, you know, these guys who are born in the early part of the 20th century and, you know, kind of at the periphery, the margin of, you know, society without a lot of privilege or education or, you know, money. And they both rise to very, you know, high heights of success and fame and fortune and then fall through their own hubris. So, you know, there's certainly a kind of American tragic similar arc to those two lives.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they're both liars. Mm-hmm. They both have some truth problems.
Not that, you know, one has to...
Well, we're all liars anyway, but...
Well, we certainly have a version of things that we like to think is the truth.
Right. We're all trying... We all have a vested interest in shaping the narrative of our own lives.
Oh, for sure.
We're not very famous, so we're not probably going to end up in a situation where other people are working very hard to shape the narrative of our lives because we're not famous enough.
Right. I certainly spent a lot of time trying to manage all that and manage people's version of my narrative.
Mm-hmm.
But not that we have to explore what the if you did this intentionally or not, but what do you think as an after sort of thought about making two documentaries about liars that you think there is an appeal for you in looking at those two different people?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think that those are the even just putting it in those terms, like making nonfiction films about liars, you know, allows you to do some pretty interesting things, I think, formally and intellectually. You get to think about the nonfiction form pretty deeply when you don't trust any of the material that you have and you sort of are constantly on red alert, you know, for bullcrap, you know, and you're sort of not sure. And in both of these films, there are these kind of self-produced archives. Like the archival materials are not like sort of what we think of as being kind of like, I don't know, third person, you know, journalistic or historical archives. They're like produced by the subjects.
That's right. So the footage really is Nixon, because he's in it. in the footage,
it's
and he's allowing
AIDS making it
right, and
so
he, he's participating actively in
right.
And in this case, John
Brinkley,
John, quote unquote Romulus,
yeah.
A.K.A. Richard, right, is another little interesting. Isn't it also interesting, or we should say John Milhouse Brinkley? Now, isn't it interesting how some of the lies are these peculiar things that, like a little thing, like a middle name, but it does on a certain level feel like a certain level. It gives it like the nuance to something that they're. Like he made up this middle name.
Yeah, I mean, so John Brinkley's middle name was really Richard, but he said sometimes in his life that it was Romulus. And so in my film, we call him John Romulus Brinkley. Mm-hmm. And that's because John Romulus Brinkley is a much cooler name. And because he had this obsession with ancient Rome and kind
sense.
Of drawing all these parallels between himself and Rome. And like, you know, this mythological kind of founder of Rome, which who that's who Romulus was. Mm-hmm. And so he, you know, so we liked the lie. The lie was better than the non-lie.
So, like you mentioned before, you said he kind of grew up poor. This is, again, John Brinkley, who's the character, the kind of the subject, not the kind of, he's the subject
definitely
of,
the subject.
Subject of nuts, exclamation point, Penny Lane's new documentary. And then he is practicing, what is he? He's a doctor with the right small town practice,
sure.
Correct?
Yeah.
And at the beginning, he...
He's like a country doctor.
He's a country doctor,
yeah.
Thank you. That's a much better way of putting it. And he prescribes to an impotent patient actually, the patient sort of looks out the window. I'm just setting it up, right? And he looks out and he sees the goat, this male goat, going at it, right? And so he was like looking on as an impotent person, an impotent man, like, oh, you know, a little bit of kind of envy about the goat. And then Brinkley, who has that aha moment, he has this an epiphany and he says, I'm going to transplant the goat's nuts into your body. Mm-hmm. And this should solve the problem. And so... You're taking from the text of his, but when you said before, for instance, that these were firsthand produced,
self-authored. Yeah.
So this was from a book that he or his diaries.
A book mm-hmm. that was written about him, mm-hmm. but yeah, written like for him. I mean, so
somebody wrote a story. Okay.
Right. So basically the book that the film is based on is called The Life of a Man, and it's called a biography. And it is a biography. Mm-hmm. It's just a biography that's like highly authorized by a person who lied for a living. So it's very suspect. Its telling of the story is not very accurate.
Right. Nowadays, of course, most people do want to be the name of a, you know, do want to make it an autobiography, but they don't want to write it. So they hire somebody to write it, but they hide the fact
I think in this case, you know, Brinkley wanted it to be a biography because he was very, very good at sort of like creating a mirage of respectability around himself. And so, you know, he had a lot of fake medical degrees. He wouldn't have said, you know, I didn't go to medical school. I know better. He knows that, you know, the medical degrees bring a certain level of authority to him and respectability and believability. And I think the same is true with the biography as opposed to an autobiography, you know?
Yeah.
So it looks like a biography. It's got a leather cover and gold letters and it's pretty thick, you know?
Right. If he had done it, it could have been interpreted as a little narcissistic. But here, somebody else is doing it. You're worthy of a published...
Yeah,
right. Yeah, understood. Yeah. So anyway, he goes on to do, because of word of mouth, he ends up doing, and press, I suppose, he ends up doing hundreds and hundreds, thousands of these operations for impotent men all over possibly the world. People traveled even in, I don't know. Anyway, so he made a fortune. And so he ended up being very wealthy. And remind me of the court. He ends up having to go to court.
Yeah, he basically sues the...
Right. Oh, he sues. That's right.
He
sues
the American Medical Association for libel because they call him a quack.
Right. Okay. They're threatened or something. They don't even know at this stage, though they may have their suspicions, they don't know at this stage that he is a charlatan.
The AMA knows that he's a charlatan.
Oh, they have a record that he is not a doctor?
Yeah, I mean, the AMA's basically mission at that point, and still, uh-huh. one of their missions is to police the boundaries of what is considered respectable mainstream medicine, and Brinkley didn't fit in that category, along with a lot of other medical practitioners at the time.
Yeah,
but they knew he was a charlatan. Yeah, that's why they called him a quack.
Well, a lot of doctors with degrees are called quacks too. So, but what was also interesting, and I think this is an interesting kind of component, I think this is something that appealed to you, if I'm not mistaken, and that was that they also built, I mean, he was also responsible for a number of enterprises and inventions, or enterprises that, you know, were quite impressive, right? Like he built this very, at the time when he built this radio station so he could talk to the country, it was like the most powerful wattage-wise, the most powerful radio station in the country at the time.
Yeah. He was a real pioneer of radio. He saw the potential in that form pretty early. Earlier than a lot of other people. So he had his first radio station in Kansas in 1923, and that was the most popular radio station in the country, according to like some polls. By 1930, it was really innovative, and it had a lot of entertaining and educational programming that other stations like the chain corporation stations, like the ones we still have, NBC, ABC, CBS, they weren't doing things like that. They were just like pretty much playing classical music all the time. And he was doing like what was considered very racy country music, you know, so like yodelers and stuff. And it's weird because now you listen to it and you're like, how could this be considered? Yeah. But it was. And so he was doing lots of innovative programming, and then also lots of kind of like innovative advertising, and, you know, kind of just using the medium of radio in ways that were kind of exciting.
Was it all sort of just a vehicle, though, ultimately, for him to basically sell his wares?
I mean, I think to some extent, yeah. But I also think that one of the things that I thought about a lot in making the film, and I think the film makes the viewers think about, is there's kind of like a, you know, in American culture, we really revere, we have this kind of trope of the outsider, innovative, maverick, inventor, entrepreneur, businessman, disruptor, you know, figure. Mm-hmm. And we love those people so much. They're not always really like nice people.
No.
You know?
Right.
They're often motivated by a range of things, including self-interest, greed, you know, megalomania, you know.
Attention,
desire, power, like all kinds of stuff that we wouldn't necessarily think are like super nice human characteristics, but they do, through the force of their own kind of inventiveness, change the world around them. And so it is a kind of dual figure, you know, like this guy, my character, very well might be a sociopath, but he also was kind of like a magician, you know, and he really did kind of find ways of creating a more interesting world, even if he was a bad guy.
And he wasn't motivated by bad.
Well, we don't know what he was motivated by. I mean, he died a long time ago.
Do we think he was? Do you think? I don't know. Put it this way: do you think he was trying to help people legitimately?
I have no idea. I'm certain that whether or not he was trying to help people, that patients looked him in the face and said, "Doc, you cured me a lot." So it seems likely that he did feel like he was a good doctor, because it seems likely to me that he kind of was a good doctor, you know?
That's different, because that kind of only reinforces his sense of hubris, or, you know, like that he's rationalizing that it's okay to lie because, you know, he's getting people, or, you know, giving testimony.
Right, but also if you are doing a surgery that you know that scientifically it has no validity, but it works, and your patients tell you that it works, and people are smiling and crying in joy, then, I mean, doesn't it work, like, you know, from his perspective? So, I mean, I'm not trying to get him off the hook. I think he was a very bad person.
Yeah, and I'm just trying to wonder.
But you asked me why he did that. We don't know. I mean, the film kind of can offer a little bit of conjecture, but it's pretty open-ended. I think he's a pretty complicated character. He could be all the above. I mean, he was motivated by a desire to provide a better life for his son than he had growing up. He was motivated by the desire to have money and he also wanted to be respected.
That seems to be central.
He wanted to be seen as legitimate.
Yeah.
And he just enjoyed fooling people. I think he probably had fun doing it. It seems like it'd be kind of fun.
Again, guess, right? We're guessing. But he was absolutely intelligent enough, it seemed. In other words, and what he was doing, and the amount he did succeed at doing, wouldn't it be just easier for him to get the degree?
Sure, but he couldn't have made the money he made with a, you know, as a regular doctor.
Oh, I see.
He was making so much more money than any doctor was making because at that time.
Because of the scam.
Yeah, I mean, doctoring was not a lucrative profession 100 years ago. It is now.
Yeah. Anyways, I guess at the end of the day, he's an enormously compelling figure and certainly has his place in history, though not a very well-known.
Not well-known at all, no. That's one of the first things that drew me to him was when I learned his story, thinking, how have I never heard this before?
How did you learn the story? How did you come across? Did you come across the book?
Yeah. Not the book, The Life of a Man. Mm-hmm. That's a very rare book because it was just a self-published biography.
Oh, okay. Did you ever get a chance to take a look at it?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It sounds like you're describing it.
No, you see it in the book. I read the book eventually, and the movie's based on that book. But there's another book about Brinkley that I read that was at the library. It's called Charlatan, and it came out in 2008.
Okay. Who wrote that?
Pope Brock, who's one of the main interview subjects in the film.
Okay. And as far as how you decided to animate the film, you want to talk about a little bit about that? Do you want to talk about how soon you figured out that this was going to be a large part of the story and a large part of how you told the story?
The idea for animated reenactments came 2 years into the process of working on it, maybe a year and a half, one and a half to 2 years in. And I had done I'd done a lot of archival research at that point, and I had a lot of material. But I had, in looking at the material, realized that it wasn't going to create a character. It was interesting, but it was all kind of promotional material for his stuff, and it wasn't like about, you know, it wasn't going to push the story forward. So I asked a friend for advice. His name was Tom, and he came on and as a writer and helped me. He said, why don't you try reenactments? And I said, well, I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to write a script or anything, or dialogue or anything like that. And he said, well, we can do it together. So he came on and then we started writing these scenes. And then we thought there would be, you know, initially we thought there'd be like 10 minutes worth of animated reenactments. And then it was 20 and then it was 30. And now it's like 56 minutes. It's well over 2/3 of the runtime.
Yeah.
It's like basically a fiction film. It just has some vestiges of the documentary that it was, it was before the animation started and took over.
That's true, I suppose. A lot of documentaries have a significant amount of reenactments.
Well over 2/3 is pretty unusual, I think.
Maybe so. You had your world premiere at Sundance. That had to feel nifty.
Yeah, that was good.
It's a good thing, right? Can't hurt.
No, it was a really good experience.
What was the reaction to it?
Well, the reaction's been pretty good. I mean, I think one of the things about making independent films and being like a little guy, like I am, is that if people hate your film, they don't tend to go out and like bash it publicly because they feel a little bad, I think. So I'm sure there are a lot of people that don't like my films, but I've had the good fortune of not being famous enough for anyone to want to like kick me publicly. I don't know. I've had like nothing but good responses, which is, I'm just saying that like, that doesn't mean everyone likes it. That just means that no one's gone out to like be really mean about it.
Right. There is when you're not, you know, a big Hollywood kind of production, enormous amount of money. You do sort of have there seems to be this get out of jail. I don't know if it's
people
a get
tend
out of
to
jail
be thing, nice. I think
it's sort of like
they're like, this is just some woman who like made this in her barn upstate New York with no help. Like maybe we'll be nice about it.
Yeah. You have a barn upstate. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I didn't really make the movie in the barn. I made the movie in the house, but you know, I do have a barn.
Do you have any goats in there?
I don't have any goats. My neighbors have goats.
Okay.
They visited.
Okay. When did Brinkley die again? I know it says it at the end of the
1942.
Okay, 1942. Because there could ostensibly be people that met him that you could have met.
Barely. I mean, it's so, you know, a few maybe, but not many at this point. And it's just not the kind of movie that I wanted to make anyway. I don't make movies where I have to go out and talk to people.
No, but I just mean subsequently. Like just, you know.
Oh, sure. I mean, some people at Q&As have said, like, you know, my dad said or, you know, whatever, stuff like that, which is cool.
Yeah. Nuts opens June 22nd Film Forum, which is also a nice venue, by the way.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah,
it's like a dream come true.
Sure. And you will be present on Wednesday night or Friday night?
Yeah, I'll be there for some Q&As the first weekend, so I'll be there Wednesday at 8, Friday at 8, and Saturday at 6:15.
Good. And so it'll have a 1 week run?
2 weeks.
2 weeks. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's not every film gets a 2 week at least not like a, you know, set up beforehand. Sometimes they, you know,
we'll see how it does.
to earn that third week, sure. And now the guess the question is: did you clear your plate with nuts? In other words, I know you were working on this before. Mm-hmm. I was talking to Morgan Neville recently, and he said that you know, he had two films that he was working on before 20 Feet from Stardom, and the success of that helped to clear up his, you know, his barn, in the sense that he had these two films, you know, Best of Enemies and this Yo-Yo Ma thing that he just came out, and then he's able to put it. So now, of course, you have the now he's also cleared his the shelves of all of his, that work, and you've done the same.
The backlog
of stuff. That's both, I can imagine, exciting and a little bit maybe stressful. I don't know.
It's not stressful. It's pretty great. The thing that's exciting is that I realized a few weeks ago or a few months ago that I hadn't, because I had been working on Nuts and our Nixon for so long, I hadn't started a new film in 6 years.
Yeah.
You know, and I now have started new films, and it's like, oh, wow. And I'm a different person. I'm like a totally different person and filmmaker than I was 6 years ago. And I have a totally different, like, sort of set of opportunities and just professional contacts, and everything sort of feels really different.
It's an all new world.
6 years ago.
It was, yeah.
So, yeah, so it's a different thing, and I'm approaching it a little differently. Mm-hmm. I felt enormously burnt out by the end of Nuts. It was a very long process, and most of it was, and I kind of feel like I always a little bit overstate this. I mean, I had support. I had a grant from Creative Capital. Tribeca Film Institute gave me a grant, as did the New York State Council on the Arts. So it wasn't like I was like all alone forever, but it was largely me alone on this film, and just kind of the only person who believed in it for, it felt like, most of it.
Did you get people just constantly questioning you?
Why are you doing this? Certainly no one would ever say that to me. It'd be very rude, but it wasn't as if it had like obvious social importance or anything. And when you get, you know, kind of constant rejections from everything, I mean, I was like getting turned down from pitch sessions. Like, I was being turned down from the opportunity to like beg for money in a humiliating way. I can't even get that, you know. So it was a weird movie, and it took a long time, and I definitely don't ever want to do a film like that again, because the amount of work that I had to do to keep optimistically working on it was a lot.
Right, which again, you were doing it alone, so yeah, it's not like you had this cadre of people saying.
It's a little bit overstating the case to say I was alone. I also, you know, Dan Kogan, my executive producer, came on, you know, about 2 years before the end, and he loved it right away and understood what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't like everybody in the world thought it was dumb. It was just really kind of hard to fund it.
An uphill climb.
It was also something else I decided very clearly was that I would never do a film again where, in this case, you know, there was so much animation. And that's great, yay, if you have the funding for it, that's wonderful. And if you don't, like, you can't do anything if you can't animate. So I'll never make a film again where I'm not guaranteed the funding, and a huge portion of the work that has to be done to make it good, I can't do myself. Like, for example, I edited Nuts. It wasn't like I wanted to, but I can edit. I ended up shooting most of it. I didn't want to, but I could. So I just decided for myself that in the future I would not do any films where so much of what was going to make it either succeed or fail was outside of my control, and I had no money for it.
It's interesting, the stuff that you can even come out of it as, no doubt you did, a stronger filmmaker, a stronger editor, stronger in many ways, from fundraiser perhaps.
Sure.
Producer, but it's not necessarily worth it.
No, exactly. It's not necessarily worth it.
You know, you can, yeah, it's the ideal situation is you have the money and you put the team together.
Well, you know, but I don't know. I do think I have a question about that too. I mean, I'm not so sure. I'm going to try. I'm going to find out. Talk to me in 3 more years. Mm-hmm. Because I'm now going to try to make films that I have funding for before I make them. And I don't know what that's like. It's new. And there's its own set of problems. I'm not like an idiot. I know that. You know, it's just a trade-off. So we'll see if those problems are better or worse than the problems that I've faced.
Well, it's realistic. Can you mention maybe a project that you're yet, or is it too soon?
I probably shouldn't talk about them yet. But I am...
No, we're not recording. What are you worried about?
We're not recording.
It's off the record.
Yeah, no. I'm working on two short films right now, and they're both commissions, and so I'm not sure I'm able to talk about them yet. But I'm really excited, because I'm really excited also to make two short films this year. And then, so seriously, by the end of 2016, I will have released my second feature film and two short films, and I feel like that's a good year.
Yeah. And they're commissioned, so you were hired.
I pitched them.
Oh, you pitched them.
They were my ideas.
Okay.
But again, right. I just don't, I was like, what would it be like to get funded before, at the beginning of the movie?
It's yeah. Let's,
so I kind of set out to try.
Yeah. Flavor.
So yeah, I thought shorts would make sense because it would be a good way to dip my toes in that water without it being like, well, if it's a nightmare, it'll be over in 6 months kind of thing. But it's not going to be a nightmare. It's been great so far.
Oh, that's great.
It's like a relief, to be like, okay, these were my ideas. These are the ideas I wanted to do anyway. And now I've got the ability to do them. And it won't take 8 years because I can hire people to help me make
them. Yeah, it's also a fruit of your labor. It's a sign of that. It's also, it's a sign of growth and of in your, in a career. It's a nice.
Plus, I love short films and I haven't gotten to make one for 6 years. So I'm excited.
Sure. And it's another conversation about, how short films are sort of finding more places now.
Yeah, short films are cool, right?
Yeah. It's like, yes, of course. But
I was so ahead of the curve. First, documentaries got cool. And now, I'm just kidding. And now shorts are cool. I'm totally joking.
So maybe you can predict what's next.
Oh, my God. I don't know. I should be thinking about that.
Nuts.
Nuts.
And I use that in an exclamatory fashion. Nuts. Because it has an exclamation point on it, is going to have its New York premiere here at Film Forum.
It's just this little place.
June 22nd. Should I bring that up? Where else is it playing? Because, my listeners aren't, I have listeners all over.
Yeah, well, that's great. Because the New York City premieres at Film Forum. And then 2 weeks later, it starts rolling out in other cities. And there's about, right now, the bookings are still happening. But right now, it's about 34 cities. So on the website, nutsthefilm.com, you can check to see which cities it's playing in. And then later this summer, it'll be available, in other ways. But for now, we're focusing on the theatrical.
Yeah, of course. It's always...
Movie theaters.
Always, yeah, go to movie theaters. It's important to go to movie theaters. And there's more movie theaters in New York now than ever, it seems. Thank you, Penny.
Thank you. This was fun.
All right, I'm glad. And now a conversation with Brent Barber, who I have known, very, very casually. I mean, extremely. I think, I've been aware of the Bicycle Film Festival. And I know that my paths have crossed with this guy, but what a great guest he turned out to be. The Bicycle Film Festival, all the films, whether they're shorts or features or whatever they are, all deal with the culture of bicycling. And this has been going on now for 16, 17 years, if you can believe it. And as I mentioned, you can, if you're listening in a country other than the United States, which some of you are, check around because I know that this festival does travel. So it may very well be in a city near you. And by the way, if it's something you think appeals to you, a film festival about bicycles or bicycling, then you should contact the Brent and his team. And you can go to the bicyclefilmfestival.com to do so. Okay, so let's just get into it. Here's my conversation with the founding director of the Bicycle Film Festival, Brent Barber. I'm excited to welcome Brent Barber to the podcast, and I'm just going to take care of a little housekeeping right off the bat. The Bicycle Film Festival will take place, oh my God, it's coming right up. How did that happen? June 22nd through the 26th. That's like next week, right? That's like in a week.
Please don't remind me because I'm...
Oh, my God. And you came over to do this. Are you out of your mind? Well, Brent, how long... It says 16th annual. How long have you been... are you a founder?
I founded the Bicycle Film Festival.
You founded it 16 years ago? What were you, just still in college? You look... oh, right. You're fit.
I'm... I don't know if everybody wants to hear this. I'm 45, and I started this when I was in my 20s.
Yeah. That's something, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I was hit by a bus riding my bike on 3rd Avenue. And at that time, New York was a different place, obviously. And
there were buses.
A lot less people biking. Uh-huh. A lot less people.
There were no bike lanes? There may not have been.
Yeah, or definitely not. The Hudson's, you know, yeah, there was the infrastructure, the conversation, the dialogue about biking was... not non-existent, but really not the way it is today, which is really good news. I really wanted to do something positive from this experience, really thinking about just doing one event. I was friends with the Anthology Film Archives. Jonas Makis gave me his blessing. I went there to have a meeting with him.
You were anointed? By Papa Makis?
I'm usually pretty conscious about using that word blessing in the right place, but yeah, I guess he's... He's more of an alchemist than a Christian priest. He had his door full of a collage of bicycle images that he had cut out of magazines. And think about that. Media at that time wasn't as accessible. He spent probably had a lot of time looking for bicycles and different imagery. And just for that meeting, it was very, very nice. And that gave me the confidence to put a lot of effort.
This is probably about 17 years ago, right?
Yeah.
He would have been 90 at the time.
So John Mary Perry over at Anthology Film Archives and I, who's now the administrative director, went through our minds and talked to a bunch of folks like what film. It was a lot more difficult to get films made, so we had to go through the archives of the last 100 years of films and try to figure out what was out there. I remember the first year we screened a film called A Sunday in Hell by Jorgen Leth, and it sold out. People were going crazy. That film was made in 1976. Jorgen Leth is, in case the audience doesn't know, is like considered the father of the dogma movement. Mm-hmm. One film that is known in this country for more mainstream audiences is Five Obstructions with Lars von Trier. But he made 40 films, three of which were cycling films. And so, in fact, in this film festival coming up,
16th,
mm-hmm. we have a really special event on... 1 week from now, on Wednesday, I found a church in Greenpoint, which is really beautiful. It's a San Damiano mission. And Blonde Redhead, who's an active participant in the Bicycle Film Festival, an incredible band from New York City, is making a live score with Janan Dara, who has put together a chamber ensemble. And it's free for everybody to come out. Please come and enjoy. You probably should RSVP first. But a little bit back to 16, 17 years ago, people really responded. We did an art exhibition in the basement of mm-hmm. Anthology. People, that happened because people said, well, I'm not a filmmaker, but I can make a painting. And I said, okay, you know, and right. So hence, let's do an art exhibition.
So you're kind of trying to create in a way more of an emphasis or on the culture of biking.
Yeah.
And by whatever means.
Yeah.
Now, you brought up this accident where you were hit by a bus. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe he was aiming. I don't know. There's a lot of hostility towards bikers, actually. Mm-hmm. But did that influence this decision to found the bicycle?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because you were injured?
Or? I had never thought about that before.
But because you were trying to do something a little bit also culturally but politically and...
Well, I have the same mindset as an activist or an advocate, but using the bicycle as an image for folks to, you know, understand how beautiful it is. And we use film and all these different mediums to show folks. And I think it's been quite effective. Since that first year, we've been to 75 cities. Over a million people have attended.
So it's a traveling festival as well?
Yeah. We've been at the Barbican Center, actually outside of New York City, because I produced the event in New York City. It's probably more organized outside of New York, but we've been at the Barbican, which is like the Lincoln Center of London, and we've been to Sydney Opera House. We've been in the warehouses in Moscow. You know, we've been all over the world, and audiences really want this to happen, and that's why I'm still doing it 16 years later. We've had, you know, high school, in this program here, we have high school kids, and we've had people who've won festivals with their films or have made big budget films.
So how many films are in this, in the festival series?
Honestly, I usually have that answer because...
Or
typically,
it's 45.
Then, 45.
Usually 45. That includes shorts,
yeah,
and,
shorts and
features.
Yeah.
And is it, yeah, I mean, how many people do you have, like, screening the films? Because you have, like, to do this every year, I understand maybe there might be some vintage content that you're also including in that number, but...
Actually, this is going back 3 or 4 years with some of the films, but I can't think of any right now vintage except the one program we have called Greatest Hits. But surprisingly to myself and almost everybody who discovers the Bicycle Film Festival the first time, there are a lot of great films out there. I mean, otherwise, I think the programming is our strength. Mm-hmm. And it's not because of me doing it. That's going to answer. I've written every program of the 350 festivals we've done worldwide since the beginning. But that's in collaboration with the artists, the filmmakers, the communities at large. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, the BMX program, you know, a lot of BMX-related folks will come over, and there's amazing work that they're doing. Mm-hmm. These people just spend every day shooting. I mean, some of the best shooters I've seen are, you know, with their bikes and, you know, doing different terrain, and it's incredible and poetic. This year, though, we're doing a surprise screening. It's not a bunch. Usually, we show a bunch of shorts for the BMX, and then just to show you how community oriented this is that the community organizes a race on the bikes to Greenpoint from Anthology after the screening to the party. You know.
Oh, right? That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, by race.
Like a BMX race.
Which means
BMX are those smaller bikes that people do tricks on. Yeah.
Oh, okay. And are on open streets?
Yeah.
It's just like however you get there.
Yeah. It might be considered illegal, but I have nothing to do with it.
Well, I do. And everybody plays fair.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Nobody gets on the subway.
You would lose if you got in the subway.
No, obviously. Anyway, I don't know why I would be nitpicking because it takes away from the fun. I mean, you're still getting to the party. And the Bicycle Film Festival, again, is going to be at the Anthology Film Archives. My listeners know where that is, at least those that are in the New York area. 32 Second Avenue. It's been there forever.
Yeah,
it's a beautiful.
It's a temple.
It's
I always describe it. I mean, going back to another religious reference. But sure. I love that place, and we've had different institutions in New York offer us to do the Bicycle Film Festival there. And one really, I guess, would be prestigious or huge institution for art. And I told Jonas Makis, that we had offered to go there, and I'm sticking loyal to Anthology. And he says, why would you do that?
Where?
I don't want to say, but like a major museum here.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay. Oh, sure, sure. Because, you know, there's the Anthology Film Market. Have you screened in Lithuania?
But we were in Estonia, and a lot of folks came from Latvia and Lithuania, and they're very knowledgeable.
Well, it's a short walk.
Yeah.
Or bike ride.
They were very knowledgeable of Jonas and his relationship. They were mostly coming from a bicycle background, and we've screened films by Lithuanian young filmmakers who were proud to have it part of the Bicycle Film Festival.
Did you ever imagine that this would take such an enormous...
No. No
place in your whole life's trajectory would be shifted by the M23. So what was the origin of that? What happened? So you were biking in Manhattan? Were you?
Yeah, uh-huh. Third Avenue near 20th Street, and I was doored, which means like when someone opens the door.
Yeah,
and
I see.
It knocked me into the way of the oncoming bus.
Oh Jesus!
And frankly, I was not bad. I mean, I had 6 months of rehabilitation, but considering it's a bus.
Yeah.
I used to have perfect teeth.
Oh, no. Come on. Wow. Well, thank gosh. I'll say again also that right now tickets are available. right? Mm-hmm. You can go to, let's see, tickets are available off of your website, I'm certain, right?
Yeah, bicyclefilmfestival.com.
That's a good mnemonic. What's the actual website? No, I'm kidding. Or by going to the Anthology's website, I assume, Anthology Film Archives.
I actually don't know. It'd be nice if they did.
Okay, and they may order, I'm sure they link to it, but yeah. Why bother? Just go to the bicyclefilmfestival.com website and order tickets and take a look at the program here. And, well, this is fantastic because you've been in my purview for years and I just never had you on the podcast before. So it's really...
I travel so much because of the festival, seven months of the year. But I've this year tried to stay, and I'm staying here as much as I can just to reconnect to all these different communities, film communities. And I was just up at the Maisel Center.
Mm-hmm. Up in Harlem.
Jonas just had a screening there of a film of his. And
really?
He
didn't have anywhere else so he could screen the film?
I think it was a really touching screening because Albert just passed. And
2 years, something like that. But yeah.
Time flies.
I know.
No, but it was really amazing. Mm-hmm. He likes to talk after the screenings and interject like some kind of wisdom. I think he took that role and no one left. For about a good 30 minutes. And
I wish I had known about it.
Yeah. It was about a film. I'm sorry, the film is escaping me. But
no problem.
He hadn't seen his family after he left during the war. And he went back after 25 years of not seeing his family, seeing his mother and other relatives.
Right.
And after the movie, he described how the KGB were following them everywhere. And they were surprised that they just had these little handheld cameras. They were expecting a big... American film crew.
was in 25 years after he left Lithuania, so it was still, must have been in the 60s or something?
Yeah, I think it was the 60s. Albert Maisels was somebody also that was involved in Bicycle Film Festival. He was participating in the art exhibition. Also, collectively, I mean, it's the first film I've directed. He's one of the camera people.
Really?
In a film. It's taking forever to finish, of course, but these are the fabric of New York. These people really set an example of what community means, and that's why I do this festival. It's incredible. Like to just even right now we're doing this interview, but later in the day I will go speak to something that's bicycle oriented rather than film oriented and all the different types of people and coming together.
So right, you have two complete cultures that converge for
and this. Then we also have an art exhibition which we have rented a 10,000 square foot warehouse in Bushwick. Our last one was here in Manhattan. We've had them every year except for last year, but the last one was in 2014 at the Marlborough Gallery, which is a blue chip gallery. We had really big names like Richard Prince, Ai Weiwei, and so on. Again, we have some big names, but I really wanted, again, bring in folks who are younger and bring it to Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. We talk about this too much, but a lot more is going on in Brooklyn sometimes. So I wanted to take it there. Erykah Badu has a piece in there.
Actually. Wow.
It's a wide range of type of people. Tom Sachs, who's been involved in a lot. And so we have like some folks coming from different backgrounds, like Tom Sachs is... well-known fine artist, and then Erykah Badu obviously is a performing artist. Mm-hmm. And then we have folks that we have like two or three bike messengers who have really incredible work as well. So
it's interesting because when you talked about how 16, 17 years ago there was such a different bike culture in New York, and I was thinking how I remember in the 80s into the 90s that the idea of a bike culture was the messenger industry. Because it was before the internet was a thing, or the web 2.0, whatever. Even email was kind of crude dial-up and all that. So people used bike messengers. I mean, when they couldn't fax something, they would use a bike messenger. And so they were ubiquitous. And they didn't have brakes.
Yeah, fixed gear bikes. Yeah.
And you'd have to really, because they would skid between, or weave between, among the tracks. So as you're crossing the street... and illegally jaywalking often, you would really have to watch yourself because you could be, look the wrong way and there's the bike messenger careening down the street. A lot of close calls back then. And it's just incredible how...
it's the city bikes you have to look out for. And there's still some bike messengers.
Or just even crossing a street in Williamsburg, but that's another story. Yeah, there is an aggressive bike now. I mean, people will complain, but there's also an aggressive car, It's a kind of a pushback on a different level. We're still seeing, after 60 years of car culture where politicians back then turned over our streets to cars. That's, you know, but it should have been a pedestrian or a non-motor culture where cars are invited.
Yeah.
You know, well, when you're talking about a congested city, cars shouldn't be in charge of our streets. I mean, you know.
Do you know where the term jaywalking came from?
Yeah. I remember that. I don't remember the term, but I do remember that it was a.
It's kind of like calling someone a
punishing. What? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
It's like country bumpkin. It's like an insult. You're like not very intelligent.
Right. Right.
And so you're not paying attention to the cars, and because a lot of people were being hit by cars when the car culture started arriving on the streets of major cities.
Sure.
I think that was there was a big campaign to like. Call people jaywalkers.
Right. Well, the big car companies, the three big three or whatever there were at the time, were, you know, paying for the right to basically co-opt the streets and, you know, and to make being pedestrians more challenging, difficult back then. So the blocks might have been very long and there weren't, you know, you couldn't cross. It was harder to give the, it was the idea was kind of to give the cars the right of way. Essentially, so anyway, but
here in New York, it hasn't totally worked. You know, I think the pedestrians are the most powerful.
Probably in the end, now that at least that there are brakes on bikes again. But thank goodness now. I mean, now you see the city bike, which is definitely it's taking over such big portions of parking
I mean,
and
downtown. Yeah. It's grown. I mean, I think not. It's not serving all parts of the city yet.
Right.
But,
okay.
But definitely, you see it. From Midtown down more.
Yeah, and in Brooklyn, I mean.
And there's some in Brooklyn, too.
Oh, my gosh, lots. I mean, really.
I got to get out to Brooklyn more, huh? Well, I will this next week, for sure.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Brent Barber, who's the founder and what's your title?
Founding director.
Founding director of the Bike Film Festival to take place in Lower Manhattan from June 22nd through the 26th. Tickets on sale for screenings right now.
Please come and enjoy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Thank you. Everybody for listening. Please do remember to subscribe on iTunes. Leave us a star rating. Leave us a comment in the iTunes. Those things help tremendously. And I don't know how to really get people to do other than promise cash gifts. But please do. We will be back next week. We've got coming up Roger Ross Williams, who is the director of a documentary called Life Animated. We have many friends of the podcast coming back. As a matter of fact, I've been emailing with Tom Noonan. He just shot the new Todd Haynes movie. Speaking of Todd's, we have Todd Solondz coming back on with Wiener Dog. We have so much stuff coming up. We also just have a bunch of friends coming back, including Joel Fendelman, Josh Bishop, Frank Hall Green. These are people that have been on before and have stopped into the studio. You're going to hear a mixture of these shows now where we have, you know, these one-on-ones, and then we have phoners, which is the term for doing an interview on the phone. And then, of course, we have these sort of more like roundtable things where I invite a couple of guests on to talk about film and film they're making, and I it's something I'm trying to create in the studio and take advantage of that. So I hope you're enjoying it. Anyway, thank you for listening to episode 357. We'll be back in just a few days, don't you know, with another episode of the podcast. My name is Adam Shartoff. The name of the podcast is, of course, Film Wax Radio. And I hope you are well. I'm off to L.A. tomorrow and be back by the end of the week. I'm meeting up with the team behind this new film called Hunter Gatherer, which I caught at South by Southwest and fell in love with. And more on that soon. Take care. Bye-bye, everybody. Well, here we have for the summer blockbuster wrap-up so far, since right now it's the beginning of summer. These are some of the superhero movies and animated movies. Jacob, our star reporter in the field, right? Hold on. What did you see so far in the last couple of months? You've seen a few. We went together and saw Batman versus Superman, right?
Yeah, that was. It's hard to explain.
Well, I'm just going to say, first of all, it was Batman versus Superman, right? Not Superman versus Batman, right?
No.
Right.
Otherwise, like, if it was called Superman versus Batman, Superman would win.
Well, a lot of people didn't end up liking that movie, but what did you... I remember when we walked out, your expectations were very high to go in, and then when you came out, you said you were a little bit disappointed.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be more like Civil War. That was a good movie.
All right, well, we're not up to that one yet, so don't jump the gun. Did you feel like
it was so long. It was like a long movie. And it took so long to get to the action. I didn't really like it. And there were so many mistakes in the movie. Like,
there were mistakes?
Yeah.
Like what?
Not
Name
like
one.
Mistakes, but they're like... It just... I think they should have, like, got a different director. Because, you know... Like,
wow.
Yeah.
I think it was the director's fault. Yeah.
No, it wasn't.
What did you think about the way they portrayed Batman and Superman? Did you think that because they really kind of departed from the normal way that those guys behaved?
Well, yeah.
Right?
Like, also, Batman was just using... He was like... I know in the Dark Knight series, he used guns and all. But then he stabbed somebody in one of them.
He stabbed somebody in this one?
Yeah, stabbed somebody.
It's really too violent. Yeah, he's very angry.
It wasn't really... Like, you could handle it, but it didn't really look real. But... It was just bad.
Now, you mentioned just now saying that it was much better was Captain Marvel Civil War. What was it called?
Captain America.
Captain America, rather.
You're going to have to cut that out. Captain Marvel?
Captain,
what
it was called
of?
Captain America Civil War. What was the right title? Civil War?
Yeah, it was based off of the comic book, obviously.
Right. And you really enjoyed that one.
Yeah, except I felt it was too short.
You felt it was too short? It was like 2.5 hours.
No, it was.
It was.
I didn't feel like that.
Oh, no, that's a good sign. That means that it was really entertaining.
Well.
That it flew by the time, right?
Yeah, but what I didn't really enjoy was I was expecting something from the comic book.
Talking to the red ball, yeah.
Okay. And that thing was in the comic books, he died, Captain America.
He did?
So I was expecting that, but then he didn't die.
No.
That would have been too big, I think. That was like the last comic series, and then he came back alive. So
which do you have? Are you partial to Marvel or DC?
Meaning, which do you prefer? The Marvel world or DC world? No, like I like DC, but Marvel has been doing much better. Like since the Dark Knight series ended, I think they should have made a fourth one, because like Robin. Like, they made Robin, like, they put Robin at the end of the last one.
Right.
And then they didn't continue that. And I have a feeling the Batman vs. Superman director is not going to continue that. He's only going to, maybe, like, if they make, like, a Red Hood movie, they might put him in there, but I don't think so.
Right. What else did you see?
I saw Angry Birds.
Angry Birds. Was that any good?
It was good.
Really
Really? Yeah, like... It was just, like, every time I see a trailer and it kind of gives away things, I learned, like, from the Angry Birds, like, after I saw that, like, I see Inside Out and it gives it away. I see, basically, Home and it, like, Home trailer, that was good, and it gives it away. And then I saw Angry Birds and I was like, and then all those movies, like, basically a trailer's almost gave it away. Yeah, and even, Zootopia, yeah, that trailer almost gave everything away. And then we all saw, and then, yeah, Zootopia, that one came out. And
right, Zootopia 3.
Zootopia 3, there's only one movie.
Oh, wait, Zootopia.
You saw that with me, I don't think.
But wasn't it a sequel, no? No, it was Zootopia.
Zootopia was the only one movie.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
That was the first
time. What was the sequel we saw? We couldn't get into Zootopia, so we went to see something, a sequel.
Kung Fu
Panda 3. Hold that down.
That was good, but
you saw Zootopia with somebody else.
Wait, let me get back to conversation. Like they almost gave away like all the trailers.
I understand.
But then it ends up like there's more to the movie. Like there's way more, like way more.
Okay.
Like,
so trailers are frustrating because they give away too much.
No, I'm saying that they don't give away too much. Like, they do give away a lot of part of the movie, but then in the movie you watch, it ends up, like...
Oh,
there
it
ends
misleads
up being
you.
Like way more in the movie.
Sure, well, of course. To wrap things up, then you just saw Finding Dory, yeah. And
that sequel was good.
On a scale of 1 to 10, where is that? Scale of 1 to 10.
Number 8. I mean,
an 8 out of 10.
Yeah.
So that's pretty good.
Yeah, but I mean, it wasn't as funny.
As what?
As Finding Nemo.
When was the last time you saw Finding Nemo? See, it's been a while.
I mean, I remember it.
What's the next thing you want to see?
Next thing? There's no next thing. I mean, Justice League. Hope that's good. But it's made by the same director of Batman vs. Superman. You can imagine how that's going to be.
Yeah.
Doctor Strange as well. That's
Doctor Strange?
No, Spider-Man. Spider-Man the movie.
Oh, the next Spider-Man, right?
The new Spider-Man movie. That's basically like the sixth movie of Spider-Man. I mean, like 6 movies. Like, this is the 6th run that's
right.
Coming out.
Very good.
In 2017, I think.
Thank you, Jacob, very much for your time. Appreciate it.
All right.
Bye-bye.
And he wanted me to make special note that you should go to his YouTube channel and like it. And what is it? Subscribe to his YouTube channel. How do they find that?
Look it up.
What do they do? Just put in... What do they search? Jacob Sharto?
Lego JPS.
Lego JPS? Okay.
Yeah, no space between Lego and JPS.
All right. What you do is you go to YouTube and search Lego JPS. That's all one word, or no spaces. Lego JPS.